Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Gregory Stockel and Jill Robbins report on orphaned children in Ukraine. John Russell has a story on the closing of the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in New Jersey. And Faith Perlow answers a question about clothes. Later, we hear part 4 of Edgar Allan Poe's The Murders in the Rue Morgue. But first,
hours after Russia invaded Ukraine in February, health workers at a children's hospital in southern Ukraine started secretly planning how to save their babies. Russians were suspected of seizing young children without parents and sending them to Russia. Knowing this, the workers at the children's hospital in Kherson began to make up information on the medical records of orphan patients. The health workers wanted to make it appear that the children were too sick to go anywhere else. "We were scared that the Russians would find out," said Dr. Olga Piliarska, the head of intensive care. "But we decided that we would save the children at any cost." Throughout the war, Russia has been accused of sending Ukrainian children to Russia or Russian-held areas to raise them as their own. At least 1,000 children were taken from schools and orphanages in Kherson during Russia's 8-month occupation of the area, local officials say. The officials still do not know where those children are.
Kherson residents say even more children would have gone missing if community members had not risked their lives to protect and hide as many children as they could. Volodymyr Zahidok is director of a social and mental services center in a village just outside of Kherson City. He falsified paperwork to hide 52 orphans and at-risk children. The 61-year-old placed some of the children with 7 of his employees. Others were taken to distant family members. Some of the older ones, he said, remained with him. "It seemed that if I did not hide my children, they would simply be taken away from me," Zahidok said. Moving them was not easy. Russia seized Kherson and much of the area in March. The Russians started separating orphans at checkpoints along roads. Zahidok was forced to get creative about how to transport the children. One time, he made up records that claimed a group of children had received treatment in the hospital and were being taken by their aunt to be reunited with their very pregnant mother. The story worked. Not all children were as lucky. At the orphanage in Kherson, about 50 children were removed in October and reportedly taken to Russia-controlled Crimea. Reporters with the Associated Press confirmed the story with a security guard at the orphanage and people who live near the area.
Earlier this year, the Associated Press reported that Russia is trying to give thousands of Ukrainian children to Russian families, either temporarily or permanently. The AP reported that officials have sent Ukrainian children to Russia or Russian-held areas against their will. The officials lied to children and told them their parents did not want them. The AP reporters found that Russian officials used the Ukrainian children for propaganda and gave them Russian families and Russian citizenship, The Institute for the Study of War, a Washington, D.C.-based group, says Russian officials are carrying out a depopulation campaign in occupied parts of Ukraine. The group says Russia is sending Ukrainian children to Russia under false claims of medical needs and adoption programs. Russian officials have repeatedly said that moving children to Russia is meant to protect them from hostilities. The Russian Foreign Ministry has rejected claims that the country is seizing and deporting the children. It has noted that the officials are searching for the family members of parentless children left in Ukraine in order to send them home when possible.
Russian children's rights representative Maria Lvova-Belova personally oversaw moving hundreds of orphans from Russian-controlled areas of Ukraine for adoption by Russian families. She has claimed that some of the children were offered the chance to return to Ukraine, but refused to do so. Her statement could not be independently confirmed. Helena Lohova is head of Kherson's military administration. She said local and national security and law officials are looking for the children who were moved, but they still do not know what happened to them. I'm Gregory Stockel.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
A popular place of interest for tourists in the U.S. state of New Jersey will be changing soon. The change involves the closing of the famous Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in Atlantic City. Museum officials said recently that it will close on December 31st after more than 26 years. The museum has unusual objects, including shrunken heads, strange animals, and representations of unbelievably tall or small humans. Atlantic City is a popular place to visit on America's East Coast. The city, between New York and Philadelphia, has over 27 million visitors a year, the city's website says. Atlantic City's boardwalk is a walkway next to the sea. The museum, as well as hotels, stores, casinos, and other points of interest, are on the boardwalk. The museum is designed with a giant globe that appears to have hit the front of the building. Chris Connolly, the museum's manager, said in a statement, "We're grateful for the support of our fans and guests, whose curiosity, open-mindedness, and enthusiasm have contributed to our success for over 26 years. He added, "We're thankful to have offered a special form of entertainment and education at the Jersey Shore, and we hope we have helped create wonderful memories for those who have come to visit." Connolly said the museum is closing because of the end of a business agreement. The future of the famous building is uncertain, although it is possible some of the building's design elements may be used in the future, Connolly said. The museum opened on the boardwalk at New York Avenue on June 22, 1996, between two famous casinos. It became popular with families looking for entertainment that did not involve gambling. The museum has 14 galleries and over 400 exhibits. They include unusual objects, such as a spider made from scissors and knives, a roulette table made of 14,000 jelly beans, and what the museum describes as the world's smallest production car. The Atlantic City Museum is one of more than 20 Ripley's museums in the U.S. and around the world. I'm John Russell.
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we will answer a question about clothes, outfits, suits, and costumes. Dear teacher, could you explain for me when to use costume, outfit, suit, and clothes, please? Kind regards, Xiao from Vietnam. Dear Xiao, thanks for this question. Costumes and suits are kinds of clothes. An outfit is a combination of clothes that you wear for the day. Let's look at each of these a little closer. Clothes is a plural noun meaning coverings we wear over our body to give protection and keep us warm or cool. Sometimes clothes we wear can be stylish or have a special meaning. By the end of the week, my dirty clothes pile up, and I need to wash them. Kinds of clothes include pants, shorts, shirts or tops, dresses, and skirts. They also include underwear and socks. I have summer clothes like skirts and shorts, and winter clothes like sweatpants and hoodies. Some clothes are worn only at special times. For example, my gym clothes include stretchy pants and a t-shirt. An outfit is a set of clothes. The word outfit is a countable noun. When I travel, I like to pack an extra outfit, just in case. On the internet, people like to share their outfits of the day, or OOTDs. A suit is a formal outfit consisting of a jacket, pants, or a skirt, and sometimes a vest, all made from the same cloth. Suits were a popular choice for work before 2020. My husband wore a blue suit to our wedding. A suit can also be a piece of clothing that you wear for a certain activity. For example, swimsuits are for swimming and other water activities. Costume has several meanings. As a noun, the first meaning is a set of clothes for a performer when they are on stage, or worn by a person for a specific reason, or an event like a holiday. During the play, the actors had to change their costumes many times. I have a full closet of dance costumes that I need to sell. What is your Halloween costume this year? My costume is a cat. The second meaning, as a non-count noun, refers to clothes worn by people during a time in history, or in a specific country or area. She dressed in her country's traditional costume for an international event. Victorian-era costumes consisted of fitted clothes, like high-collared shirts and long skirts for women that did not reveal much skin. And we use costume as an adjective, describing something like a play or film set in the past where actors use clothing from that time period. The television show Outlander is a costume drama set in the 1700s in countries like Scotland, France, and the United States. Please let us know if these explanations and examples have helped you. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perlow.
You just heard Faith Perlow present this week's Ask a Teacher segment. Hi, Faith. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the show again.
This week you talked about the difference between clothes and outfits. Do you have any types of clothes or styles that you like?
I do. I really enjoy vintage clothes, Dan.
What can you tell us about vintage clothes? And what does vintage mean?
Vintage is an adjective that means old, but cherished or loved because of its age. I love buying and wearing vintage dresses and skirts from the 1950s and 1960s. There is a lot of fabric, and the skirts are really poofy or big because of all the layers underneath.
Where would you find something like that?
You can find them in thrift stores sometimes, but for real vintage clothes, you have to go to antique stores. Those are stores that only have vintage or old things. You should come with me sometime, Dan. Antique stores even have vintage suits for men.
Maybe I'll take you up on that offer. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Dan.
The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe, Part 4.
Murder had come to the old house on the street called Rue Morgue. Murder had come and gone and left behind the bodies of an old woman and her daughter. It was a perplexing crime scene. The damage to the daughter's body suggested a killer of superhuman strength. The knife that had killed the old woman, almost separating head from body, was in the room. But the old woman's body was outside, behind the house. The door and windows to the house, all firmly closed, locked on the inside. Voices had been heard. One voice was speaking in French. The other voice had not spoken even one word that anyone could understand. And yet, there was no one in the room when police arrived moments after the attack. My friend Dupin was now explaining to me what he had learned when we visited the scene of the crime.
I knew that what seemed impossible must be proved possible. The killer, and I believe there was just one, escaped through one of these windows. After the murderer had left, he could have closed the window from the outside, but he could not have fastened the nail. Yet anyone could see the nails which held the windows tightly closed. This was the fact that stopped the police. How could the murderer put the nail back in its place?
That's the problem, Dupin. Perhaps if you pulled out the nail?
Yes, that is just what I thought. Two things seemed clear. First, there had to be something wrong with the idea that the nails were holding the windows closed. Second, if it was not the nails which were holding the windows closed, then something else was holding them closed, something hard to see, something hidden. So I checked the first window again. I removed the nail. Then I again tried to raise the window. it was still firmly closed. There had to be a hidden lock, I thought, inside the window. I searched the window frame. Indeed, I found a button which, when I pressed it, opened an inner lock. I raised the window with ease. Now I knew that the killer could close the window from outside and the window would lock itself. But there was still the nail. So I returned the nail, pressed the button, and again tried to raise the window. The nail held the window closed.
Then the window could not have been the means of escape.
That window, no. The killer did not escape through it. But I went again to the other window. The nail there looked the same as the one I had just seen. I moved the bed so that I could look closely. Yes, there was a button here too. I was so sure I was right that without touching the nail, I pressed the button and tried to raise the window. And guess what happened?
I knew the answer, but I let Dupin have the satisfaction of reporting. The window went up, he told me.
As the window went up, it carried with it the top part of the nail, the head. When I closed the window, the head of the nail was again in its place. It looked just as it had looked before. The nail was broken, but looked whole. And what is impossible is proved otherwise.
So the murderer went out that window. Did he arrive in the room by that path as well? Dupin answered, although it seemed he was speaking more to himself than to me.
It was a hot summer night. Would the victim have opened the window to get some fresh night air? Most likely.
So the killer found it open and entered, I said. Dupin nodded.
And as he came in, the window locked when it closed. The lock held the window closed, not the nail, as it appeared to investigators. Again, that which seemed impossible was actually possible.
Dupin's eyes were shining with the satisfaction discovery brings. He was analyzing evidence, and his unusual reasoning ability had found a great purpose. I suddenly understood. This is why going to the house on the Rue Morgue seemed pleasing to Dupin. The use of his sharp mental abilities made him happy. And I had more work to provide that great brain. Dupin, the windows are on the fourth floor, far above the ground. Even an open window. Dupin shook his head up and down slowly.
Yes, that is an interesting question. How did the murderer go from the window down to the ground and vice versa? But I had looked around carefully outside, you recall. And I knew a way. And the answer to this question told me still more about the identity of the killer. Do you remember, friend, the lightning rod attached to the house?
Yes. A metal pole, and quite narrow. It protects the building from lightning strikes. But it is so tall and thin.
True. It would take great strength and agility to get up the pole. Some kinds of animals might climb it easily, yes? But surely not every man could. In fact, maybe very few men. Those of very special strength and special training. This helped create a better picture of the murderer, but still not sharp enough to recognize. I still had the question, who? We know the killer climbed the pole, entered the room through the window, murdered and destroyed all order in the room.
he managed to push one body up the chimney. He threw the other, almost headless, out the window. Then he left the way he came. We can answer the how of the crime, but who? Such unspeakable viciousness. What human could do this to another?
Dupin continued, trance-like again, seeming to speak to himself as much as to me.
Perhaps we can come closer to answering the question of who by exploring the question of why.
But Dupin, the police said the motive must have been robbery.
But, my friend, what was taken? The police said they could not answer the question. They said they did not know what the women had. Maybe clothes and jewelry, the investigators proposed. But neighbors described the women as nearly hermits, rarely, if ever, leaving the house. Of what use would fine clothes and costly jewelry be to them?
Dupin's eyes were glistening, his brows pointing sharply down, as he circled me, thinking aloud.
But what is more telling than what the killer might have taken is what he left behind, conveniently in bags in the center of the room.
Of course, the money. You are right, Dupin. It makes no sense. All the money delivered from the bank to the old woman, right there on the floor? Why would the attacker have passed on the riches? A thief certainly would not.
So I want you to forget the investigators' claim that the killer acted out of a desire for money. They thought this only because they knew the money had arrived just 3 days before the killings. But that was just chance. If gold was the reason for the murders, the killer must have been quite a fool to forget and leave it there. No, I think that there was no reason for these killings except, perhaps, fear. The wild nature of the attack leads me to a motive of fear.
An interesting theory, Dupin. Fear can bring out the crazed beast in a person.
In any living thing. Now let us look at the murders themselves. A girl is killed by powerful hands around her neck. Then the body is placed in the opening over the fireplace, head down. Unusual, even by the standards of the most terrible criminals. Think also of the great strength needed to put the body where it was found. It took several men to pull it out. Also, the hair pulled from the head of the old woman. You saw it on the floor yourself, and you saw the blood and skin still attached. It takes great force to pull out even 20 or 30 hairs at a time. But this was hair and scalp. And there was no reason to almost take off the woman's head just to kill her.
It is extremely odd, I agree, especially since there is no evidence that the killer knew the victims. No one could hate a stranger enough to carry out such torture. Dupin's eyes narrowed.
Exactly.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.